Daniel 1, 1 through 7. Let us hear God's word. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God. And he brought the vessels into the treasure house of his God. And the king spake to Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel and of the king's seed and of the princes, children in whom was no blemish, but well favored, and skillful in all wisdom and cunning in knowledge, and understanding science, and such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning and the tongue of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed them a daily provision of the king's meat, and of the wine which he drank, so nourishing them 3 years, that at the end thereof they might stand before the king. Now among these were of the children of Judah Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, unto whom the prince of the eunuchs gave names, for he gave unto Daniel the name Belteshazzar, and to Hananiah of Shadrach, and to Mishael of Meshach, and unto Azariah of Abednego. Thus ends the reading of God's holy and inspired word. Now this Lord's Day morning, we come to begin a series of sermons on the book of Daniel. And before we begin to look at chapter 1, verse 1, I thought it's appropriate for us to have a little introduction to this book. I think we need to consider the author of the book, the historical setting of the book, and then a brief outline of the book before we jump in at chapter 1, verse 1. First, we have to realize that the book is written by Daniel. And though he doesn't speak in the first person in the first part of the book, in the second part of the book, we find him speaking in the first person. We also find that Daniel is commanded to preserve the book in Daniel chapter 12, verse 4. But if that's not enough for us, to realize that Daniel, a man in this period during the Babylonian captivity, was given interpretations of dreams and dreams and visions and prophecies of things that would happen many years later, we can be assured of these things when we consider Christ's testimony. In the Olivet Discourse, in Matthew chapter 24, verse 15, Jesus speaks of the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet. Jesus does not lie. And Jesus tells us that Daniel has spoken to us about the desolation or the abomination of desolation there in Matthew 24:15, and it's parallel in Mark 13:14. Now, this book of Daniel is not found in the Hebrew Bible in the section of the prophets. It's in fact found in what's called the writings. And we might ask, why is this book in the writings? I think the answer is that Daniel did not occupy the office of a prophet, even though he had the gift of a prophet. He possessed prophetic gifts, and yet he wasn't in the office of a prophet. And I believe that's why it was placed in the writings in the Hebrew Bible. We also learn in the book that it's not all prophecy. And we'll see that in a minute as we consider the outline of the book. Let us also consider the setting or the historical setting of the book. Be reminded that at the death of Solomon, Jeroboam I of the northern kingdom rebelled against Rehoboam, and there was a schism in 931 BC, and 10 tribes went and served Jeroboam in what's known as the northern kingdom. The northern kingdom was taken captive by the Assyrians, the northern kingdom, north of them in 722 BC. Now this book, Daniel, is set in the period of the 70-year captivity, not of the northern people, but of the southern kingdom. The beginning of this book takes place in year 605 BC. at the beginning of the Babylonian captivity. The Babylonians have just defeated the Assyrians, and now they come and take over in Jerusalem. This is what's known as the period of indignation that the prophet Isaiah speaks of in Isaiah 10, particularly in verses 5 and 25, where there God through Isaiah says, I'm going to bring judgment upon you Assyrians by another nation. And so God brings that upon the Assyrians through the Babylonians, and then He also chastens His people through the Babylonians. What we have to remember is this exile that we've just read of in 2 Chronicles 36 and is just mentioned here brings about the end of the independent existence of the nation of Israel as a theocracy. They are no longer and will no longer be a sovereign nation. And that's a pretty big deal for those that are waiting for the consolation of Israel and expecting Messiah to come and bring in the kingdom. What we have in this book is a period covered about 70 years from the beginning of the Babylonian captivity in 605 BC by Nebuchadnezzar, which is spoken of in 2 Chronicles 36, 5 and following, that we just read. And the rebuilding of the temple started in 535 BC by Cyrus. So we have this 70-year period covered in this book. And Daniel is in the midst of the whole book. He's approximately 14 or 15 at the beginning of the book. He's 85 at the end. And he served at least four major monarchs in that time period, and he may have served some of the others that aren't mentioned in this book. Let's consider briefly the outline of the book. First, in the first six chapters, we have an historical section. The first six chapters are predominantly historical. Yes, there are some visions and some interpretations, but for the most part, they're historically set. Chapters 7 through 12 are prophetical. As I said, Daniel in this book serves at least four heathen monarchs. What we have to understand, though, is that this book is not historical from chapter 1 to chapter 12. In chapters 1, 2, 3, and 4, we find him serving under Nebuchadnezzar. Then in chapter 5, we find him serving under Belteshazzar. We have a historical example of what took place, just one historical vignette of all his service under Belteshazzar. But in chapter 7 and 8, in the prophetic section, we find that he had two visions that took place while he served Belteshazzar, and we find that those visions actually took place before the historical event that's specified in chapter 5. Now, it's really not too hard if we read this book slowly to pick that up. But most of us, quite often, when we read the Bible, fail to pick some of these things up. So I think it's important to recognize that. We have Daniel serving under Darius in chapter 6. And then in chapters 11 and 12, we learn of some things that the Lord told him during that period of his service and of his life. And then in chapter 10, we learn about his service under Cyrus, or what he was given by God when he served Cyrus. So the book isn't in historical, chronological order. And as we go through, I'll try to bring that up so we can remember as to what the setting is that we find ourselves in. Now this morning I thought it was important to set the historical context of this book and to kind of pave the way as an introduction to next week's sermon as we consider Daniel himself and his character and his resolve. But let's look first at Nebuchadnezzar's domination this Lord's Day morning. His military domination in verses 1 and 2, and his cultural domination in verses 3 through 7. Nebuchadnezzar's domination, militarily and culturally. We've seen that he takes over Assyria and then Jerusalem. He takes over the southern kingdom and its capital, and he begins to reign. He allows Jehoiakim to reign as a tributary to him, and that lasted about 8 years until Jehoiakim rebelled against him to his own ruin. We have in this period this 70-year captivity in Babylon, which Jeremiah had prophesied before it took place in Jeremiah 25:12. God did this. He punished the people of God for failure to keep the 7-year Sabbath. And so he says, I'm going to give the land the rest that you failed to give it. You failed to give it 70 years worth or 490 years worth, and so it's going to get that rest that I prescribed. God speaks of that in 2 Chronicles 36:21, referring back to that ceremonial law of Leviticus 25:4 and 5 regarding the Sabbath, the seventh year of rest. Now here in verses 1 and 2, we see Jerusalem taken by Nebuchadnezzar and Jerusalem given to Nebuchadnezzar. I think that's important for us to realize. Nebuchadnezzar took Jerusalem, and at the same time, it was given to him by God. His own strength played a factor in one sense, and yet in another sense it didn't at all. Because God gave it to him. There were three deportments that are referred to in that passage we've just looked at in 2 Chronicles 36. It's also referred to in 2 Kings chapters 24 and 25 in the parallel. We have that first deportment in 2 Chronicles 36, 1 through 8, under Jehoiakim. Then we have the second in 36, 9 and 10, under Jehoiachin, his son. And then the third in verses 11 and 13 through Zedekiah, his other son. You have to remember that this deportation took place between Jerusalem and Babylon. Babylon was a city found between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, more than 500 miles to the east of Jerusalem, across the Arabian desert. You might think that Daniel one day was in Jerusalem and the next day he was in Babylon. And yet we find out that 100 years later in Ezra chapter 7 that it took Ezra 4 months to get from Babylon to Jerusalem. So he's not there immediately. He's part of a group of the cream of the crop of Israel that have been taken out in this first deportation. And he comes to Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar takes the city. And he fulfills, we learn, his full wrath against the city in this third deportation. When he takes all the vessels, when he destroys the temple, when he destroys the wall, and the full wrath of Nebuchadnezzar is poured out upon Zedekiah as God had prophesied through Isaiah in chapter 39. The book of Isaiah. So we see Jerusalem taken by Nebuchadnezzar in verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem and besieged it. This word besieged literally means to confine or to enclose. In other words, he surrounded it. He cut off all their sources of escape. And he brought them into bondage. But we see in verse 2 that though Nebuchadnezzar took Jerusalem, we see that it was also given to him. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasure house of his God. Here we see God giving it to Nebuchadnezzar. Notice that the word Lord there in verse 2 only has the letter L capitalized. It doesn't have O-R-D capitalized. If it did, it would be speaking about the covenant name Yahweh. But in fact, what we have is and the Lord, or and Adonai, gave. The ruler, the king, but it's not speaking about the covenant God. It obviously is speaking about him, but it's referring to him by his standard name as God. He is God. God of all these false gods of the Babylonians. He's the ruler. He's the one that rules over all these so-called substandard rulers. He gives this city and this empire to the king, Nebuchadnezzar. He also gives him, it says, part of the vessels of the house of God, or some of the vessels of the house of God. To a God-fearing lover of Yahweh, the fact that some of the vessels, some of the things that were set apart wholly unto God for His worship, being given into the hands of a heathen king so that he could put it in his temple to worship his false god, was a big deal. They were not excited. They were discouraged, you can imagine. Not only were some of the cream of their crop taken, but now also some of the vessels of the house of God were taken. God speaks about this in Jeremiah 27. When this deportation took place, Jeremiah remained there. Daniel goes to Babylon. Ezekiel accompanies him there and prophesies to God's people in Babylon. Jeremiah remains in Jerusalem. He prophesies to those that had not been taken. And in Jeremiah 27, 14 through 18, Jeremiah, God speaks through Jeremiah and reminds some of the people that are still there about these vessels. He says, therefore, in verse 14, hearken not unto the words of the prophets that speak unto you, saying, ye shall not serve the king of Babylon, for they prophesy a lie unto you. For I have not sent them, saith the Lord, yet they prophesy a lie in my name, that I might drive you out, and that ye might perish, ye and the prophets that prophesy unto you. Also I spake to the priests and to all this people, saying, thus saith the Lord, hearken not to the words of your prophets that prophesy unto you, saying, behold, the vessels of the Lord's house shall now shortly be brought again from Babylon, for they prophesy a lie unto you. Hearken not unto them. Serve the king of Babylon and live. Wherefore should this city be laid waste? But if they be prophets, and if the word of the Lord be with them, let them now make intercession to the Lord of hosts, that the vessels which are left in the house of the Lord and in the house of the king of Judah and in Jerusalem go not to Babylon. You see, Jeremiah is speaking about several different times when he prophesied. He says there was one time before any of the vessels were taken that people were saying they weren't going to be taken. Men were coming and saying they were speaking in God's name. Don't worry, they won't be taken. Jeremiah says, no, they're not real prophets. They will be taken. And then when some are taken, he says, I had to prophesy again against these false prophets. Now, it appears the same men, the ones that said they wouldn't be taken, and they were, now they're saying, oh, don't worry, we'll get them back. No more will go. We'll get them back. And Jeremiah says, no, that's not what God is saying. You're listening, and this is only going to cause more of them to go. This is only going to bring your God's judgment upon us further. If they're real prophets, if they're real priests, they ought to be praying that they'd be returned. Not saying peace, peace, and buying it when it wasn't peace. They fell for the lie. These vessels were brought to the house. It refers to the temple of his God, of Nebuchadnezzar's God, not of God, of his false God. Whether it was the God of Belus or of Marduk, we don't know for sure. But he took it to one of his false God's temples. We see his military domination. He'd been victorious against the awesome Assyrian kingdom. It was nothing for him to take Jerusalem. And he took it the way he wanted to take it. He took the cream of the crop away and then ruled over it through its Davidic kings. In verses 1 and 2, we see Nebuchadnezzar's military strength, and then in verses 3 through 7, we see his cultural domination and strength as well. I've mentioned already his plan. It was to take the cream of the crop and to make the Jewish intelligentsia and aristocracy Chaldeans. That was his goal. That was his means of incorporation. We'll see later that Cyrus had a different plan when he comes to rule over the then known world. He recognizes that there's some value for the different ethnic peoples to have their own ethnic religions and mores and cultures, and that's the way he allows it to be. There's more pluralism under Cyrus, but here under Nebuchadnezzar, he's going to have some domination, not only militarily, but also culturally and religiously. He's going to affect, his desire is to affect these young men. They're approximately 14 years old. We don't know how many of them. There are more than the four that are mentioned. Remember, Daniel lives till the end of this book 70 years later. So he lives a long life at that period of time, that many years before Christ. We see in verse 3 that King Nebuchadnezzar spake unto Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs. Now this word eunuch means officer. Some of the officers of kings in antiquity were in fact eunuchs and did not marry. But Potiphar is called by this same word in Genesis 37:36, and we know he had a wife. So this term is used generically, and it's referring to an officer. It's like a cabinet member or an important counselor. This man is chief or prince of them. He's the master of them. And he tells them, this is what we're going to do with these young children. Here we have a fulfillment of the prophecy of Isaiah 39:7. There in Isaiah 39:7 we read these words, "And of thy sons that shall issue from thee, which thou shalt beget, shall they take away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon." God had told them that this was going to happen from the seed of their princes, of their aristocracy. We see who was selected in verses 3 and 4a. They were children, could be translated young men. They're in that 13 to 15 year old period, we would believe. They were of Israel, we learn. And then that is expanded. And of the king's seed and of the princes. It's the aristocracy's youth. We go on to see in 4a about these children, "in whom was no blemish but well favored." They were good looking young men. That was important to serve the king. "And skillful in all wisdom and cunning and knowledge and understanding science, and such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace." They weren't only good looking, they were intelligent. They had capability and they were already exercising. They'd already demonstrated it in their own culture. It says not only did they know cunning and knowledge and skillful in wisdom and understanding science, they also had ability in them to stand in the king's palace. This word ability refers to competence or strength. And as I've considered it, it's likely to me referring to communication skills. Because it's one thing to know a lot if you can't pass that knowledge on. But these counselors had to be able to pass it on. It required a certain degree of tact and also a certain degree of ability to communicate the knowledge and the understanding that they had. They were prepared in all ways to serve in this capacity. Now, why were they selected? We see that at the end of verse 5. They were selected so that they might stand before the king. If you remember, in antiquity, and particularly in the Babylonian period, kings did not just go amongst the people and shake hands and kiss babies. Very few select citizens ever saw the king face to face. It was part of his honor and dignity in their perspective that he wouldn't go amongst the people. And so when it talks of standing before him, it means of having intercourse with him, of having relations with him, of being able to influence him, and then being able to serve him in carrying out his commands amongst the people. They were selected to serve. They were promised a 3-year full ride, room and board, all tuition paid, and they had a guaranteed job at the end. And a pretty prestigious job at the end. Their tickets were punched, and they had it made. Not just Daniel, not just his 3 friends, other Jewish cream of the crop as well. Now we've seen who they are, why they've been selected. Let's consider how they were to be influenced. What was Nebuchadnezzar's plan? What was his strategy to have cultural dominion and religious dominion amongst the people of God? He conquered them militarily. He took their city. But the question was, would he take their soul? That was his goal. That was his goal. Let's look at verse 4b through 7 to see how he had that domination. The first thing he did was he gave them a cultural indoctrination in verse 4b. And whom they might teach the learning and the tongue of the Chaldeans. That was the intent. Get the sharpest guys together and teach them the culture of the Chaldeans. The learning, literally the literature and the tongue, the language. They had to learn the cuneiform language of the Babylonians. It wasn't something that they would have been taught in Jerusalem, no matter how bright they were. This wasn't their second language. They had to learn it, and they had to learn the literature of the Chaldeans. We're going to see this word Chaldeans used in a narrow sense later as referring to those officers, those magi, those astrologers, and all sorts that were around the king. But here, clearly, it's in a more general ethnic sense. It's referring to the Babylonian or Chaldean culture in general. We're going to expose them to the language and the literature. We're going to give them a complete liberal arts education in this culture. Full ride, room and board, we're going to teach them everything about this culture. They're indoctrinated culturally in verse 4. Then in verse 5 we find that they are indoctrinated religiously, I would contend. In verse 5 we learn this, and the king appointed them a daily provision of the king's meat, of the wine which he drank, so nourishing them 3 years, that at the end thereof they might stand before the king. He not only had a curriculum for them, he also had a diet for all those enrolled in this training process that would be the princes of the Jewish people for years to come. He had a plan. But there's something apparently going on here that's much deeper or not, is not on the surface of this verse. And that is that history tells us that these meals were presided over by heathen priests. So what we see is that these meals were daily sacramental meals for the false gods of the Babylonians. There was something more going on here. They were being exposed to the false religions prevalent then. They were being exposed to the polytheism. They were being exposed to the divining that was going on amongst the astrologers there. So they were not only indoctrinated culturally, they were seeking to indoctrinate them religiously as well. Consider, they've spent 4 months going across the Arabian desert. They likely weren't bound, but they couldn't run away. They get there to Babylon. There is no temple. There is no synagogue. We learn in Psalm 137 that they're taunted to sing songs of Zion there by the rivers. Now, there wasn't great persecution, but there was an ongoing pressure being applied. There was persecution in that sense, cultural and religious pressure being applied to these young men. And if that wasn't enough, their names were changed. Their names were changed. In the midst of applying the pressure on them culturally and religiously, their names are changed. We find in the Scriptures that there are changes of names at critical stages in people's lives. Some of them for good, some of them for evil. I think some of them probably come to mind immediately. Genesis 17:5, when Abram becomes Abraham. Genesis 32:28, when Jacob becomes Israel. But we also find in Genesis 41:45 that Joseph is renamed as he takes some level of authority in the Egyptian Empire. We see here in 2 Kings 23:34 and 2 Kings 24:17. We just referred to it in 2 Chronicles 36:4. Eliakim's name is changed to Jehoiakim. Pharaoh Necho of Egypt changes his name because he wants a new identity to this man. He doesn't want this man to think he's the king of Israel anymore. He wants him to understand he's under his heel. And Mattaniah's name is changed to Zedekiah by Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon in 2 Kings 24:17. That's not referred to there in 2 Chronicles 36. But he has a name change as well. Now, what do we make of these changes of names? Does anybody see any commonality in these names of these four Hebrew boys? Do you notice the ends of their names, children? Two of them end with E-L-L and two with I-A-J, or in Hebrew, J-A-H. Two L's, two Yahs. What do we learn from that? All of these four children were given names to remind them of their God. El being God, Yah referring to Yahweh. All four of them had been given names by their parents to remind them of their service to the triune God of Israel. Daniel means the judgment of God. And his name is changed to Belteshazzar, which is the keeper of the keys of the treasury of the false god Bel. His name isn't just changed to some innocuous name. Now his name reminds him of a false god. Hananiah, which means Yahweh has been gracious. His name is changed to Shadrach, which refers to Marduk, or the inspiration of the sun. They're being reoriented, aren't they? A name to a Jew meant a lot. The Jewish people understood in a name a character, a direction, an orientation of life, a commitment to a God. Mishael, who is like God, is changed to Meshach, referring to the goddess Shak, which is like a Babylonian Venus or Aphrodite. A very unclean god. Azariah, or Yahweh has helped, is changed to Abednego. I know most people pronounce it Abednego, but it's referring to the servant of Nebo. Abed, servant, Nego, or Nebo, which is referring to a shining fire, another false god. Their names are changed for a reason. Nebuchadnezzar was trying to wipe out any memory of their gods in their minds and hearts. Calvin says that, quote, the design of the king was to lead these youths to adopt the customs of the Chaldeans, that they might have nothing in common with the chosen people. He had military domination, but he also was seeking to have cultural domination. And he was seeking it amongst the cream of the crop of the youth. He had a wise strategy. He was getting at the foundation of the future society of that ethnic race. If he could affect those future leaders, he would have that ethnic religious people. He'd have them not only militarily, but he'd have them religiously / culturally. He would have their soul and also their city. That's what he sought after. Let me in just a few minutes apply this text to our current situation. Remember Augustine, not Augustine, that's a city in Florida. My history professor, Dr. Singer, used to say, St. Augustine is in heaven. Or no, St. Augustine is in Florida, St. Augustine is in heaven. Augustine wrote a book called The City of God, didn't he? He contrasted with the city of men. He was speaking about the eventual decline of the Roman culture. He was speaking about the vision that Nebuchadnezzar had in chapter 2 about how the stone, not the rock, that was made without hands, crushed all the human empires when it came upon the world scene under the Roman Empire. But at this time, can you imagine that it looked like the city of man had won? God's people are waiting for the Messiah, and now the northern Babylonian kingdom has taken them over, ripped the cream of the crop from them, culturally impressing upon them their false views. This was it for the people of God as a sovereign nation. But what we see in this book is that God yet has a purpose for the city of God. And He will bring the city of God to victory. He's reminding God's people through Daniel as they're in Babylon, that is what will take place. And yet, God uses faithful men there in Babylon. He uses Daniel and others who are not impacted, who are not conformed to the image of the Chaldean culture and religion. He maintains His remnant there, His leaders amongst His people. And He gives them visions and interpretations of visions to encourage God's people in the midst of this very difficult strait or trial that they're facing. There is a battle waging for the hearts and minds of people. There are cultural wars going on. They always have been. There's been a battle since Genesis 3 and Genesis 3:15 between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. And there's no truce between the two. The battle wages. And so Paul can say in Philippians 1:29, "For unto you it is given in the behalf of Christ, not only to believe on Him, but also to suffer for His sake." Paul says, you've gotten two gifts. You've got the gift of salvation, but it doesn't come without the gift of suffering. Yes, some of that suffering comes as God prunes us, yet some of that suffering comes because we fall into sin, and some of it comes because of the irreconcilable war that wages between Satan's cohorts and the people of God under the captain of our salvation, Jesus Christ. That's why Samuel Rutherford could say this, "You will not get leave to steal quietly to heaven in Christ's company without conflict." That's not an option, he says. Just echoing the words of Paul. And it's especially fierce amongst the youth. It's the next generation. Would we expect Satan and his cohorts to apply the pressure where the pressure isn't best utilized? They're going to attack the front that's the most strategic. Is that any surprise? It shouldn't be. And it's a scary thing to think about how much of our ungodly culture can be found, and this is just one example, in the local Christian bookstore. You think it's not there? Go look at those trinkets that which try to suggest that somehow Christianity is some sentimental, weak, feminized whatever. It wouldn't let you know there's a war going on, would there? And what about those half-dressed girls with bedroom eyes on the CDs? It pervades even the Christian culture. And that's just one example, people. I don't hammer this kind of stuff every week. That's just one example. The world and Satan are after our children. We better pay attention. And our culture is declining rapidly. And it has for years. The foundations are nearly destroyed. We haven't been taken over militarily. But have we been culturally? Of course. An English statesman, Lord Hellam, said this of the UK, and I think it's true of our country. He said, "Our country is being destroyed before our eyes by a conspiracy of intellectuals without faith, delinquents without honor, muckrakers without charity or compassion. Young men who have never dreamed dreams, and old men who have never seen visions." Oh, for men that have dreamed dreams. Oh, for young men that have dreamed dreams and have the God-given courage to stay the course, to see the dream fulfilled by serving Christ in this generation. Next week, young ones, young adults, young men, young women will consider Daniel's fortitude in the midst of this pressure to give himself in. Don't do it. Don't do it. Stay the course. See what God has promised to do in the midst of His people.